The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
I'm Mike Consul.
And I'm Loretta Klotfelter.
Welcome to Inside the Edition for the October issue of Institutional Real Estate Americas. Loretta, there is the real estate category that just keeps on giving. That would be data centers, which I understand is one of your lead stories in the October edition. Tell us about it.
Just to step back a little bit, I am really excited about data centers. I think that this is an emerging asset class. I mean, I don't think anyone was even talking about a data center 10 years ago. They existed 10 years ago, but it was not an asset class the way we're starting to think of it now. But I am really excited about this emerging asset class and the potential therein. And so for that reason, I said, you know, let's do a story. Let's really sort of take a deep dive into what data centers are, how they work, what makes them different from other commercial real estate. And, you know, the result was this really, really exciting article that we have titled Cloudy with a Chance of Windfall. And it's because we're talking about being in the cloud.
And windfalls of profits.
Yes, they are. So that's sort of the background. I think that the data center industry has a lot of interesting, it's an interesting story this year. You talked about returns. A lot of the data centers are currently owned by REITs. That's one way to invest in the asset class. And data center REITs are, as of the end of September, they are the best performing subsector in the FTSE NAREIT All Equities Property Index subsector. You know what I'm talking about, the NAREIT
exactly.
Index.
I like this story a lot. In fact, I like it so much that I picked it up for Real Assets Advisor magazine as well. You had some pretty astounding, actually it was authored by Michael Lester, one of our former editors with the organization, now a contributing writer, and he had some pretty astounding growth statistics in a projection for the growth of the industry and the amount of money that the big cloud providers like Microsoft and Amazon are investing is pretty astounding.
Yeah, it's really astonishing the size that it's grown in. And the reason that we need to talk about this, you know, a data center is at its core a building full of computer servers. And we are using so much data. The amount of data that we use on the internet, on mobile phones, is growing exponentially, and therefore the property required to house those storage sites is growing exponentially. I mean, you know, people talk about what is the cloud. This is the cloud. This is where the cloud lives. The cloud lives in these data centers. And there are a lot of them, and you know, what we're seeing is just astonishing.
You know, the article, I have it here in front of me, and it actually says that the top three cloud providers, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, spent $31 billion in 2016 to expand and extend their data centers around the world. And the major cloud providers are anticipating they will triple their infrastructure by 2020. Which, as the article says, is nothing but good news for the real estate sector.
Indeed. And, you know, different of these companies have a different relationship with data centers. Amazon tends to own its own data centers. But some of the other big players, such as Microsoft, are much more likely to lease. You know, and so you can see that, for instance, another one, Equinix, which is one of the big data center REITs, the biggest, in fact, with a market capitalization of over $31 billion. They purchased 29 data centers this year from Verizon. And this is one of those, you know, sort of sale-leaseback deals where, you know, Verizon didn't see the need to own its own data centers. But it does need the data.
You know, the interesting thing also, data centers are, They're so hot right now. I'd like to talk a little bit about what is a potential Achilles heel with this industry. You've got large data centers, according to the article, use as much electricity as a small town in some cases, 40 to 80 times the energy of traditional office space, and energy use over the next 5 years, or make that over the past 5 years, has doubled. So now there's a way to address that, because obviously you can use renewable energy, you can build on-site solar, wind, geothermal, something along those lines. There's also the question, though, about, I think there's two things that would give me a little bit of pause. One is hacking, and apparently they've been pretty good about keeping hackers out. But maybe even more than that is miniaturization. You stop and think about how much power a small computer has. I mean, we talk about our smartphones being more powerful than the computers that sent a man to the moon. The miniaturization marches ahead. So the thought is, over time, this footprint potentially is going to shrink quite a bit. A lot less space needed.
Just because the data is stored, you know, on an apples-to-apples basis in a smaller space, I still think that the amount of data that we're going to need going forward, you know, when we talk about new technologies like driverless cars, for instance, the amount of data storage that's going to be required for a single driverless car, you know, we might be able to store them on smaller servers, you know, tinier disks, but we're going to need a lot more of them. So mm-hmm. I wouldn't be worried. The power issue, that's a significant one. That's a real challenge. And that is why you'll see a lot of these data centers, being located where there is power. So either near cheap power from hydro or wind is another option. You know, you're really going to see that being the priced in. And also, you know, the thing to remember, the way that rents are priced, the way that, you know, you don't talk about a price per square foot in data centers. You talk about a price per kilowatt. You know, you charge based on the energy used.
So some of these companies have actually made a commitment to be completely renewable. For instance, Google. Now, I don't know if they own their own data centers. Do you know, Loretta? If they lease, I suppose they're off the hook as far as saying, hey, everything we own is powered by renewable energy. That would kind of get them off the hook. Do they own their own data centers?
Well, the thing to keep in mind, and we actually did a story about this earlier in the year, but the way that Google is meeting its renewable power commitments is, to a certain extent, through buying power over the open market in a way that they're sort of buying these renewable credits. So the data center itself might be hooked up to a grid, and the grid itself might be pulling from whatever the local power plant is, which might be coal or natural gas, et cetera. But then they're buying these renewable power credits that allow them to say that they are, you know, using renewable power through this sort of power shifting. Mm. I sound a little skeptical, because it is a little bit of a...
Sounds like a shell game.
Well, it's an accounting trick. And, you know, that's... Whatever the cause of it, they are able to sort of shift things around and say, well, it all counts as renewable power because we're buying this other renewable power that makes up for the non-renewable power that's actually powering the data center.
And I'm not trying to diminish those efforts. I mean, efforts that these companies are making is pretty extraordinary.
The alternative is just to do nothing. So the what they're doing right now, it is the right direction. But I think there's still more that can be done as far as looking at where the power comes from, because these are huge power sucks. That is the biggest cost as a landlord, is just, you know, the energy costs involved. And while it's true that, you know, because you're pricing based on the energy cost, you can you're passing that through to the tenants, the who are using the data, it does continue to be sort of an Achilles heel, as you described it.
Now, you mentioned that REITs are major owners of these data centers, and the article says U.S. REITs and one REIT in Europe make up 25% of the global market of third-party data center owners and operators. So the REIT market, as you said, the statistics show that it's doing very well. Is there any anticipation that in a real estate correction that the data center REITs may continue to outperform, to perform positively?
Well, the if you're looking at the stock market performance of the data center REITs, you've really seen them sort of moving, you know, as their own sector, separate from the broader REIT trends. And, you know, obviously this year that's been great. I think they're up over 25% year to date. Like, that's just really strong performance, especially when you consider that REITs as a whole are, you know, maybe up 5%, 6%. So, like, they're really outperforming the broader REIT sector. But I think part of that is that they're very differentiated. You know, the drivers that are going to push data center performance and data center REIT performance are just going to be really different from the drivers that are pushing sort of the you know, your basic office or retail REITs. It's not that they're both I mean, they both do follow a business cycle, a real estate, sort of the real estate supply and demand, the economic cycle. But the trends are different. And also on the REIT side, the investors who are coming into the data center seem to, there is some thinking that they might be a different, you know, they're going at it for different reasons than traditional REIT investors might be. That it is less, well, it's you know, so the data center REITs are really much, really sort of a considered a growth stock, whereas REITs in general are really more of a value stock. And so you do see that sort of bifurcation between REITs, you know, your traditional REITs and your data center REITs as the sort of growth sector that might be attracting people who wouldn't otherwise invest in real estate or REIT stocks, but are perhaps more interested in technology stocks, and this is, you know, a way to buy a tech stock. So they have some of the qualities of tech investment, as opposed to just, you know, what some might consider boring real estate, but others might consider, you know, a good real estate investment.
Right. Hey, now, any category that gets hot, we always start to hear calls about beware of overbuilding. I haven't heard any talk like that around data centers. Have you heard any worries that because it's such a hot category and the returns have been so good that there's a threat of overbuilding?
Not yet. Partly because the demand is just so strong right now. And so, you know, you want to look at the top markets for data centers in the U.S. The biggest right now, the amount of building going on is Northern Virginia, which might surprise you to know that Northern Virginia is actually the number one data center market in the world.
Is because it's the nation's capital, right next to the nation's capital. Is that what's driving it there?
You know, I actually suspect it has more to do with they have a strong tech and a strong defense technology, you know, maybe, you know, is part of what's driving it. But yeah, Northern Virginia is the largest data center market in the country. Other big markets, Dallas, San Jose, Seattle has quite a bit of data, you know, so a lot of the usual tech suspects. But yeah, Northern Virginia has really been seeing a building boom right now, and that's because that's where the demand is.
Well, and they try to locate these things. Now, San Jose being an exception, but they tend to locate data centers in places that are very seismically stable, have a lot of or very little in the way of potential for natural disasters, is my understanding. Because this is data. I mean, you can imagine they're holding banking data. And vital data of all kinds that they have to make sure is protected. And so my understanding is that they really look at the geography and the climatic conditions, the potential for natural disasters to help safeguard it beyond all the security they need to provide from hacking.
For sure, for sure. But you also do see that they locate near the users in to a certain extent as well, because especially, you know, if you look at somewhere like one of the other major markets, I think it ranks about number 5 as far as data center hubs is New York, New Jersey. And, you know, one thing you'll see there is, you know, high-frequency traders want to locate their data center as close as possible to the New York Stock Exchange's servers, because every, you know, millisecond, is it millisecond or microsecond?
I think it's millisecond.
Nanosecond. Let's just say nanosecond. Okay. Every nanosecond counts when you're a high-frequency trader, and the when you're moving at the speed of light, you want to be, that actually matters. You want to be as close as possible.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, when we use our browsers and we're going on the internet, it never seems to move at a nanosecond speed. I can tell you that.
Well, I don't think we're doing a lot of high frequency trading here at the office, are we?
Fortunately not.
The beauty of real estate is it's generally not a high frequency trade.
But it is a benchmarking business, and that's another story you had mentioned that appears in the issue, has to do with benchmarking. What angle did you take on the benchmarking story?
Right. So this was a market perspective by Roy Schneiderman at Bard. Bard Consulting, and he wanted to take a look at how benchmarks, real estate benchmarks, are getting more and more attention. You know, it's investors really, really focus on their benchmarks, but he wanted to just ask, what is the cost of focusing on benchmarks, and, you know, should we focus less on benchmarks? Because what he was saying is that performance benchmarks, and this is, you know, looking at performing performance benchmarks compared to an index, not peer benchmarking, but performance against mm-hmm. some sort of outside index or benchmark list, is becoming more and more important. It's how decisions are being made, but that there are risks that could come from that. So, you know, one thing he talks about is the herd mentality that you get when everyone's sort of herding around a particular benchmark. You know, another is that the benchmarks as they exist now don't do a very good job of evaluating value-added and opportunistic investments, that they're really more core benchmarks as far as, you know, something like the Odyssey or the NPI. And then, you know, you run into some issues around paying performance and the application to manager evaluation. You know, that when, you know, when you're using a benchmark to affect manager compensation, then the manager will naturally become more and more focused on meeting the benchmark. But, you know, you may not necessarily be getting the best possible performance, but just the closest to the benchmark performance.
It's like teaching to the test.
It really is. That's exactly it, right? That's exactly what happens. And so, for instance, if the benchmark that you're comparing against has a particular geographic or property type profile, your investments are going to more closely match that profile, even though doing something else might actually be a better investment. But you don't go that way. You just match to the benchmark because that's safer.
I would assume that we're going to see more benchmarks and more elaborate benchmarks because of, and this is a podcast that we had done a while back, big data coming into the real estate business and just the ability to gather and analyze data.
Which gets stored in data centers.
Exactly. could fuel exactly what Roy Schneiderman was warning against, that over-reliance on these benchmarks and creating this kind of herd mentality.
Yeah, I mean, it is a risk. It is a risk for the market. So that is something to be aware of, to be considerate of, and just to be mindful of.
You also had something to say about Los Angeles in the Olympic Games. LA was awarded the Olympics for 2024, Tokyo for 2020. And you mentioned to me before we started recording a little bit about how the Olympic Committee has kind of changed its perspective a little bit on awarding the Olympics to various cities. Can you elaborate on that for our listeners?
Well, I think anyone who's familiar with some of the pitfalls that happened with some of the recent Olympics, Rio de Janeiro, for instance, is that when a city needs to sort of rapidly develop its infrastructure in order to support an event like the Olympics, sometimes those things don't get done. Sometimes they're not done as well as they could be, and then afterwards you're left with these, you know, sort of building husks that the city didn't need in the first place. And so it's a lot of infrastructure development that might not actually be the best possible use of that city's infrastructure. The great thing about Los Angeles is they don't really have to build anything going into this Olympics. LA's it's a world-class city. It's hosted the Olympics before. It's got everything it needs already, and they've been doing a really fantastic job on their public transit and their the LA subway these days. The LA Metro is really, you know, they've been having this huge building push as far as developing the infrastructure there. So I think the Olympic Committee looked at Los Angeles and said, yeah, they can do this without putting quite the strain on the city.
Yeah, that's always the we'll build it if you give us the Olympics is always a kind of a dicey affair. And you had mentioned, though, that the Olympic Committee was so impressed with both Tokyo and Los Angeles's proposals for the Olympics or bids for the Olympics that they just decided we'll go with Tokyo in 2020 and ahead of schedule, just LA, you've got 2024. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, a correction. It was the LA 2024 effort, but that actually LA will be in 2028 and Tokyo will be in 2024.
Oh, I see.
So that's the thing. They were doing their 2024 selection, and the LA 2024 program was the bid that was selected, but they'll actually be hosting the Olympics in 2028, which gives plenty of time. You know, that's 10 years out now to put everything in place that needs to be put in place. But honestly, there's not that much required, and that's why when the Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, looked at LA's bid for the 2024 Olympics, they said, "You're great. We're going to pick two this time," and they picked Tokyo and LA. For the summer games, it's going to be quite the event.
And of course, Los Angeles famously made money on the Olympics. Not only didn't go into hock, but made money on the Olympics when Peter Ueberroth was head of the whole effort. And presumably, they could pull that off again, especially since, as you say, they don't have to really build all the infrastructure's there. They don't really need to build anything. It's just come to LA and let the games begin. Of course, great economic stimulation. You've mentioned before that because of the transit going on in transit stations, there's a lot of development starting to gather around transportation hubs, which is a natural in a city like that. So it sounds like LA's got a lot of good things going for it right now.
It really does. And, you know, you're definitely seeing a lot of this urban infill happening, this walkable, transit focused. And, you know, we're talking about Los Angeles, and this doesn't sound like the Los Angeles of the popular consciousness, which is people in cars commuting. And let's be real, LA has some terrible traffic. But we are really seeing a move toward a dense walkable node, you know, these dense walkable nodes around transit centers where there's just a lot of development focused on that. And so the rollout of the Expo line and some of the other metro lines has been really, really positive for the development in the city.
And just quickly before we run out of time, Loretta, the November edition's in the offing. Is there any anything you can highlight for our listeners about what's coming in the November edition?
Well, we take a look at a suburban suburban property in the November issue. You know, we've been, the last decade has been all about CBD, urban infill, and downtown development, both office, residential, et cetera. But the past two years, last 18 to 24 months, we're really starting to see some resurgence in the suburbs. But the suburbs are changing to reflect people's more urban desires. So you're seeing transit-oriented, walkable, suburban property, and that's really where things are going right now.
So kind of clusters of development, it sounds like. They would just cluster development instead of putting it on a thoroughfare, let's say, or spreading it out.
Yeah, and it's just what, you know, it's a response to what people are looking for, which, you know, people are starting to move toward, you know, they talk about how millennials are definitely getting older and looking at the suburbs for the reasons that people have always looked at the suburbs, more space, better schools, etc. But, you know, they want the amenities of an urban lifestyle transplanted to the suburbs. And so that's really what we're seeing happening in a variety of places around the country.
We'll look forward to that. Loretta, thanks.
All right.